Jen Shinnen gestured acknowledgement. And no one here is ever really starving, Lieutenant. No one has to work. They just fish in the swamp, or fleece visitors during pilgrimage season. They have no chance to develop any ambition or any desire to improve themselves. And they don't, can't really, develop any sort of sophistication, any kind of... She trailed off, searching for the right word. Interiority? Suggested Lieutenant Skyot, who enjoyed this game much more than Lieutenant On did. That's it exactly, agreed Jen Shinnen. Interiority, yes. So your theory is, said Lieutenant On, her tone dangerously even, that the Orzeans aren't really people. Well, not individuals. Jen Shinnen seemed to sense remotely that she'd said something to make Lieutenant On angry, but didn't seem entirely certain of it. Not as such.
And of course, interjected Jen Ta, oblivious, they see what we have and don't understand that you have to work for that sort of life. And they're envious and resentful and blame us for not letting them have it. When if they'd only work...
They send what money they have to support that half-broken-down temple, and then complain they're poor, said Jen Shinnen. And they fish out the marsh, and then blame us. They'll do the same to you, Lieutenant, when you open the prohibited zones again.
Your dredging up the mud by the ton to sell as fertilizer didn't have anything to do with the fish disappearing? Asked Lieutenant On. Her voice edged. Actually, the fertilizer had been a byproduct of the main business of selling the mud to space-dwelling Tanmint for religious purposes.
That was due to irresponsible fishing on the part of the Orzeans?
Well, of course it had some effect, said Genta. But if they'd only managed their resources properly...
Quite right, agreed Jen Shinnen. You blame me for ruining the fishing, but I gave those people jobs, opportunities to improve their lives.
Lieutenant Skyot must have sensed that Lieutenant On was at a dangerous point.
Security on a planet is very different from on a station, she said, her voice cheerful. On a planet, there's always going to be some slippage, some things you don't see.
Ah, said Jen Shinnen. But you've got everyone tagged, so you always know where we are.
Yes, agreed Lieutenant Skyot. But we're not always watching. I suppose you could grow an AI big enough to watch a whole planet, but I don't think anyone has ever tried it. A station, though.
I watched Lieutenant On see Lieutenant Skyot spring the trap Jen Shinnen had walked into moments ago.
On a station, Lieutenant On said, the AI sees everything.
So much easier to manage, agreed Lieutenant Skyot happily. Almost no need for security at all.
That wasn't quite true, but this was no time to point that out. Jen Ta set down her utensil.
Surely the AI doesn't see everything.
Neither lieutenant said anything.
Even when you...
Everything, answered Lieutenant On. I assure you, citizen. Silence for nearly 2 seconds. Beside me... Lieutenant Skyot's 7 Issa guard's mouth twitched. Something that might have been an itch, or some unavoidable muscle spasm, but was, I suspected, the only outward manifestation of her amusement. Military ships possessed AIs just as stations did, and Rodchai soldiers lived utterly without privacy. Lieutenant Skyot broke the silence.
Your niece, citizen, is taking the aptitudes this year?
The cousin gestured yes, So long as her own farming provided income, she wouldn't need an assignment, and neither would her heir. However many heirs the land might support. The niece, however, had lost her parents during the annexation.
"These aptitudes," said Jen Shinnen. "You took them, lieutenants?"
Both indicated affirmatively. The aptitudes were the only way into the military or any government post, though that didn't encompass all assignments available.
"No doubt," said Jen Shinnen. "The test works well for you, but I wonder if it's suited to us Shasernans."
"Why is that?" asked Lieutenant Skyot, with slightly frowning amusement. "Has there been a problem?" asked Lieutenant On, still stiff, still annoyed with Jen Shinnen.
"Well..."
Jen Shinnen picked up a napkin, soft and bleached a snowy white, and wiped her mouth.
"Word is, last month in Kuldves, all the candidates for civil service were ethnic Orzians."
Lieutenant On blinked in confusion. Lieutenant Skyot smiled.
"You mean to say," she said, looking at Jen Shinnen, but also directing her words to Lieutenant On, "that you think the testing is biased?"
Jen Shinnen folded her napkin and set it down on the table beside her bowl.
"Come now, Lieutenant, let us be honest. There's a reason so few Orzians occupied such posts before you arrived. Every now and then you find an exception. The Divine is a very respectable person, I grant you. But she's an exception. So when I see 20 Orzians destined for civil service posts and not a single Tanmind, I can't help but think either the test is flawed or, well... I can't help but remember that it was the Orzians who first surrendered when you arrived. I can't blame you for appreciating that, for wanting to acknowledge that, but it's a mistake."
Lieutenant On said nothing. Lieutenant Skyot asked,
"Assuming you're correct, why would that be a mistake?"
"It's as I said before. They just aren't suited to positions of authority. Some exceptions, yes, but..."
She waved a gloved hand.
"And with the bias of the assignments being so obvious, people won't have confidence in it."
Lieutenant Skyot's smile grew broader, in proportion to Lieutenant On's silent, indignant anger.
"Your niece is nervous?"
"A bit," admitted the cousin.
"Understandably," drawled Lieutenant Skyot. "It's a momentous event in any citizen's life, but she needn't fear."
Jen Shinnen laughed, sardonic.
"Needn't fear? The lower city resents us, always has, and now we can't make any legal contracts without either taking transport to Kuldves or going through the lower city to your house, Lieutenant."
Any legally binding contract had to be made in the Temple of Amat, or a recent and extremely controversial concession on its steps, if one of the parties was an exclusive monotheist.
"During that pilgrimage thing, it's nearly impossible. We either lose an entire day traveling to Kuldves, or endanger ourselves."
Jen Shinnen visited Kuldves quite frequently, often merely to visit friends or shop. All the Tanmind in the upper city did, and had done so before the annexation.
"Has there been some unreported difficulty?" asked Lieutenant On, stiff, angry, utterly polite.
"Well," said Jen Ta, "in fact, Lieutenant, I've been wanting to mention... We've been here a few days, and my niece seems to have had a bit of trouble in the lower city. I told her it was better not to go, but you know how teenagers are when you tell them not to do something."
"What sort of trouble?" asked Lieutenant On.
"Oh," said Jen Shinnen, "you know the sort of thing. Rude words, threats, Empty, no doubt, and of course nothing next to what things will be like in a week or two. But the child was quite shaken.
The child in question had spent the past two afternoons staring at the Four Temple water and sighing. I had spoken to her once, and she had turned her head away without answering. After that, I had left her alone. No one had troubled her. No problems that I saw, I messaged Lieutenant On. "I'll keep an eye on her," said Lieutenant On, silently acknowledging my information with a twitch of her fingers.
"Thank you, Lieutenant," said Jenshinen. "I know we can count on you."
"You think it's funny."
Lieutenant On tried to relax her too tight jaw. I could tell from the increasing tension of her facial muscles that without intervention she would soon have a headache. Lieutenant Skyot, walking beside her, laughed outright.
"It's pure comedy. Forgive me, my dear, but the angrier you get, the more painstakingly correct your speech becomes, and the more Jen Shinnan mistakes you."
"Surely not. Surely she's asked about me."
"You're still angry. Worse," said Lieutenant Skyot, hooking her arm around Lieutenant On's. "You're angry with me."
"I'm sorry, and she has asked, very obliquely, just interested in you. Only natural, of course."
"And you answered," suggested Lieutenant On, "equally obliquely."
I walked behind them, alongside the seven Issa who had stood with me in Jen Shinnan's dining room. Directly ahead, along the street and across the Four Temple water, I could see myself where I stood in the plaza. Lieutenant Skyot said,
"I said nothing untrue. I told her that lieutenants on ships with ancillaries tended to be from old, high-ranking families with lots of money and clients. Her connections in Kuld Ves might have said a bit more, but not much. On the one hand, since you aren't such a person, they have cause to resent you. On the other hand, you do command ancillaries and not vulgar human troops, which the old-fashioned deplore just as much as they deplore the scions of obscure nobody houses getting assigned as officers. They approve of your ancillaries and disapprove of your antecedents. Jen Shinnan gets a very ambivalent picture of you."
Her voice was quiet, pitched so that only someone standing very near could hear it, though the houses we passed were closed up and dark on the lower levels. It was very unlike the lower city, where even late into the night, people sat nearly in the street, even small children.
"Besides," Lieutenant Skyot said, "she's right. Oh, not that foolishness about Orzians, no. But she's right to be suspicious about the aptitudes. You know yourself, the tests are susceptible to manipulation."
Lieutenant On felt a sick, betrayed indignation at Lieutenant Skyot's words, but said nothing, and Lieutenant Skyot continued.
"For centuries, only the wealthy and well-connected tested as suitable for certain jobs. Like, say, officers in the military. In the last, what, 50, 75 years, that hasn't been true. Have the lesser houses suddenly begun to produce officer candidates where they didn't before?"
"I don't like where you're headed with this," snapped Lieutenant On, tugging slightly at their linked arms, trying to pull away. "I didn't expect it from you."
"No, no," protested Lieutenant Skyot, and didn't let her go. Drew her closer. "The question is the right one, and the answer the same. The answer is no, of course. But does that mean the tests were rigged before, or rigged now?"
"And your opinion?"
"Both, before and now. And our friend Jen Shinnan doesn't fully understand that the question can even be asked. She just knows that if you're going to succeed, you've got to have the right connections. And she knows the aptitudes are part of that. And she's utterly shameless.
You heard her imply the Orzeans were being rewarded for collaboration, and in nearly the same breath, imply her people would be even better collaborators. And you notice neither she nor her cousin are sending their own children for testing. Just this orphaned niece. Still, they're invested in her doing well. If we'd asked for a bribe to ensure it, she'd have handed it over, no question. I'm surprised she didn't offer one, actually.
You wouldn't, protested Lieutenant Ahn. You won't. You can't deliver anyway.
I won't need to. The child will test well, likely get herself sent to the territorial capital for training to take a nice civil service post. If you ask me, the Orzeans are being rewarded for collaborating. But they're a minority in this system. And now the unavoidable unpleasantness of the annexation is over, we want people to start realizing that being Rod Chai will benefit them. Punishing local houses for not being quick enough to surrender won't help. They walked in silence for a bit and stopped at the edge of the water, arms still linked.
Walk you home? Asked Lieutenant Skyatt.
Lieutenant Ahn didn't answer, but looked away over the water, still angry. The green skylights in the temple's slanted roof shone, and light poured out the open doors onto the plaza and reflected on the water. This was a season of nightly vigils. Lieutenant Skyatt said with an apologetic half-smile,
I've upset you. Let me make it up to you.
Sure, said Lieutenant Ahn, with a small sigh.
She never could resist Lieutenant Skyatt, and indeed, there was no real reason to do so.
They turned and walked along the water's edge.
What's the difference?
Lieutenant Ahn said, so quietly it didn't seem like a break in the silence.
Between citizens and non-citizens.
One is civilized, said Lieutenant Skyatt with a laugh, and the other isn't.
The joke only made sense in Rod Chai. Citizen and civilized are the same word. To be Rod Chai is to be civilized. So in the moment the Lord of Mianai bestowed citizenship on the Shasernans, in that very instant, they became civilized. The sentence was a circular one. The question Lieutenant Ahn was asking is a difficult one in that language. I mean, one day your Issas are shooting people for failing to speak respectfully enough. Don't tell me it didn't happen, because I know it did, and worse. And it doesn't matter because they're not Rod Chai, not civilized. Lieutenant Ahn had switched momentarily into the bit of the local Orzean language she knew, because the Rod Chai words refused to let her mean what she wished to say. And any measures are justified in the name of civilization.
Well, said Lieutenant Skyatt, it was effective, you have to admit. Everyone speaks very respectfully to us these days.
Lieutenant Ahn was silent, unamused.
What brought this on?
Lieutenant Ahn told her about her conversation with the head priest the day before.
Ah, well, you didn't protest at the time.
What good would it have done?
Absolutely none, answered Lieutenant Skyatt. But that's not why you didn't. Besides, even if ancillaries don't beat people or take bribes or rape or shoot people out of pique, those people human troops shot, 100 years ago, they'd have been stored in suspension for future use as ancillary segments. Do you know how many we still have stockpiled? Justice of Torrens Holds will be full of ancillaries for the next 1,000,000 years, if not longer. Those people are effectively dead, so what's the difference? And you don't like me saying that, but here's the truth. Luxury always comes at someone else's expense. One of the many advantages of civilization is that one doesn't generally have to see that if one doesn't wish. You're free to enjoy its benefits without troubling your conscience.
It doesn't trouble yours?
Lieutenant Skyot laughed gaily, as though they were discussing something completely different, a game of counters or a good tea shop. When you grow up, knowing that you deserve to be on top, that the lesser houses exist to serve your house's glorious destiny, you take such things for granted. You're born assuming that someone else is paying the cost of your life. It's just the way things are. What happens during annexation? It's a difference of degree, not a difference of kind.
It doesn't seem that way to me, answered Lieutenant Awn, short and bitter.
No, of course it doesn't, answered Lieutenant Skyot, her voice kinder. I'm quite sure she genuinely liked Lieutenant Awn. I know that Lieutenant Awn liked her. Even if Lieutenant Skyot sometimes said things that upset her, like this evening. Your family has been paying some of that cost, however small. Maybe that makes it easier to sympathize with whoever might be paying for you. And I'm sure it's hard not to think of what your own ancestors went through when they were annexed.
Your ancestors were never annexed. Lieutenant Awn's voice was biting.
Well, some of them probably were, admitted Lieutenant Skyot. But they're not in the official genealogy.
She stopped, pulling Lieutenant Awn to a halt beside her.
Awn, my good friend, don't trouble yourself over things you can't help. Things are as they are. You have nothing to reproach yourself with.
You've just said we all do.
That wasn't what I said.
Lieutenant Skyot's voice was gentle.
But you'll take it that way all the same, won't you? Listen, life will be better here because we're here. It already is, not just for the people here, but for those who were transported. And even for Jen Shinnen, even though just now she's preoccupied with her own resentment at no longer being the highest authority in Oars. She'll come around in time, they all will.
And the dead?
Are dead. No use fretting over them.
Chapter 5.
When Savardin woke, she was fidgety and irritable. She asked me twice who I was and complained three times that my answer, which was a lie in any event, conveyed no meaningful information to her.
I don't know anyone named Breck. I've never seen you before in my life. Where am I?
Nowhere with a name.
You're on Nilt.
She drew a blanket around her bare shoulders and then, sulkily, shoved it off again and folded her arms across her chest.
I've never even heard of Nilt. How did I end up here?
I have no idea. I set the food I was holding down on the floor in front of her. She reached for the blanket again.
I don't want that.
I gestured my indifference. I had eaten and rested while she slept. Does this happen to you often?
What?
Waking up and finding you don't know where you are, who you're with, or how you got there? She fidgeted the blanket on and off again and rubbed her arms and wrists together.
A couple of times.
I'm Breck, from the Gerentate. I had already told her, but I knew she would ask me again. I found you 2 days ago in front of a tavern. I don't know how you got there. You would have died if I'd left you. I'm sorry if that's what you wanted. For some reason that angered her.
How very charming you are, Breck from the Gerentate.
She sneered slightly as she said it. It was mildly, irrationally surprising to hear that tone from her, naked and disheveled as she was, and not in uniform. That tone made me angry. I knew very precisely why I was angry, and knew as well that if I dared to explain my anger to Savardin, she would respond with nothing but contempt, and that made me even angrier.
I held my face in the neutral, slightly interested expression I had used with her from the moment she'd awakened, and made the same indifferent gesture I had made moments before. I had been the first ship Savardin ever served on. She'd arrived fresh out of training, 17 years old, plunged straight into the tail end of an annexation. In a tunnel carved through red-brown stone, under the surface of a small moon, she had been ordered to guard a line of prisoners, 19 of them, crouched naked and shivering along the chill passageway, waiting to be evaluated. Actually, I was doing the guarding. 7 of me ranged along the corridor, weapons ready. Savardin, so young then, still slight, dark hair, brown skin, and brown eyes unremarkable, unlike the aristocratic lines of her face, including a nose she hadn't quite grown into yet. Nervous, yes, left in charge here just days after arriving, but also proud of herself and her sudden, small authority. Proud of that dark brown uniform jacket, trousers, and gloves, that lieutenant's insignia. And, I thought, a tiny bit too excited at holding an actual gun in what certainly wasn't a training exercise. One of the people along the wall, broad-shouldered, muscled, cradling a broken arm against her torso, wept noisily, moaning each exhale, gasping every inhale. She knew, everyone in this line knew, that they would either be stored for future use as ancillaries, like the ancillaries of mine that stood before them even now, identities gone, bodies, appendages to a Rod-Chai warship, or else they would be disposed of. Savardin, pacing importantly up and down the line, grew more irritated with this piteous captive's every convulsive breath, until finally she halted in front of her.
Otter's tits! Stop that noise!
Small movements of Savardin's arm muscles told me she was about to raise her weapon. No one would have cared if she'd taken the butt of her gun and beaten the prisoner senseless. No one would have cared if she'd shot the prisoner in the head, so long as no vital equipment was damaged in the process. Human bodies to make into ancillaries weren't exactly a scarce resource. I stepped in front of her. "Lieutenant," I said, flat and toneless, "the tea you asked for is ready." Actually, it had been ready 5 minutes before, but I'd said nothing, held it in reserve. In the readings coming from that terribly young Lieutenant Savardin, I saw startlement, frustration, anger, irritation.
"That was 15 minutes ago," she snapped.
I didn't answer. Behind me, the prisoner still sobbed and moaned.
"Can't you shut her up?"
"I'll do my best, Lieutenant," I said, though I knew there was only one way to really do that. Only one thing that would silence that captive's grief. The newly minted Lieutenant Savardin seemed unaware of that. 21 years after arriving on Justice of Torin, just over 1,000 years before I found her in the snow, Savardin was senior-esque lieutenant. 38, still quite young by Rod-Chai standards. A citizen could live some 200 years. Her last day, she sat drinking tea on her bunk in her quarters, 3 meters by 2 meters by two, white-walled, severely neat. She was grown into that aristocratic nose by now, grown into herself, no longer awkward or unsure. Beside her on the tightly made-up bunk sat the Esk Decade's most junior lieutenant, arrived just weeks ago, a sort of cousin of Savardin's, though from another house. Taller than Savardin had been at that age, broader, a bit more graceful. Mostly. Nervous at being asked to confer in private here with a senior lieutenant, cousin or no, but concealing it. Savardin said to her, "You want to be careful, Lieutenant, who you favor with your attentions." The very young lieutenant frowned, embarrassed, realizing suddenly what this was about.
You know who I mean,
continued Savardin, and I knew too. One of the other Esk lieutenants had definitely noticed when the very young lieutenant had come on board, had been slowly, discreetly, sounding out the possibility of the very young lieutenant perhaps noticing her back. But not so discreetly that Savardin hadn't seen it. In fact, the entire decade room had seen it, and seen as well the very young lieutenant's intrigued response.
I know who you mean, said the very young lieutenant, indignant. But I don't see why...
Ah, said Savardin, sharp and peremptory.
You think it's harmless fun.
Well, it would probably be fun.
Savardin had slept with the lieutenant in question herself at one point, and knew whereof she spoke.
But it wouldn't be harmless. She's a good enough officer, but her house is very provincial. If she weren't senior to you, there would be no problem.
The very young lieutenant's house was definitely not very provincial. Naive as she was, she knew immediately what Savardin meant, and was angry enough at it to address Savardin in a way that was less formal than propriety demanded.
Otter's tits, cousin. No one said anything about clientage.
No one could. None of us can make contracts until we retire.
Among the wealthy, clientage was a very hierarchical relationship. A patron promised certain sorts of assistance to her client, both financial and social, and a client provided support and services to her patron. These were promises that could last generations. In the oldest, most prestigious houses, the servants were nearly all the descendants of clients, for instance, and many businesses owned by wealthy houses were staffed by client branches of lower ones.
These provincial houses are ambitious, Savardin explained, voice the slightest bit condescending, and clever as well, or they wouldn't have gotten as far as they have. She's senior to you, and you've both got years to serve yet. Grant her intimacy on those terms, let it continue, and depend on it. One of these days she'll be offering you clientage when it ought to be the other way around. I don't think your mother would thank you for exposing your house to that sort of insult.
The very young lieutenant's face heated with anger and chagrin. The shine of her first adult romance suddenly gone, the whole thing turned sordid and calculating. Savardin leaned forward, reached out for the tea flask and stopped, with a surge of irritation, said silently to me, the fingers of her free hand twitching, "This cuff has been torn for 3 days." I said directly into her ear, "I'm sorry, Lieutenant." I ought to have offered to make the repair immediately, dispatched a segment of one esk to take the offending shirt away. I ought, in fact, to have mended it 3 days before, ought not to have dressed her in that shirt that day. Silence in the cramped compartment, the very young lieutenant still preoccupied with her discomfiture. Then I said directly into Savardin's ear, "Lieutenant, the decade commander will see you at your earliest convenience." I had known the promotion was coming, had taken a petty satisfaction in the fact that even if she ordered me that moment to mend her sleeve, I would have no time to do it. As soon as she left her quarters, I started packing her things, and 3 hours later she was on her way to her new command, freshly made captain of Sword of Nathtas. I hadn't been particularly sorry to see her go. Such small things. It wasn't Savardin's fault if she had reacted badly in a situation that few, if any, 17-year-olds could have handled with aplomb. It was hardly surprising that she was precisely as snobby as she had been brought up to be. Not her fault that over my, at the time, 1,000 years of existence, I had come to have a higher opinion of ability then of breeding, and had seen more than one very provincial house rise far enough to lose that label and turn out its own versions of Savarden. All the years between young Lieutenant Savarden and Captain Savarden, they were made up of tiny moments, minor things. I never hated Savarden. I had just never particularly liked her. But I couldn't see her now without thinking of someone else. The next week at Striegen's house was unpleasant. Savarden needed constant looking after and frequent cleaning up. She ate very little, which in some respects was fortunate, and I had to work to make sure she didn't get dehydrated. But by the end of the week, she was keeping her food down and sleeping at least intermittently. Even so, she slept lightly, twitching and turning, often trembling, breathing hard, and waking suddenly. When she was awake and not weeping, she complained that everything was too harsh, too rough, too loud, too bright. Another few days after that, when she thought I was asleep, she went to the outer door and stared out over the snow, and then put on her clothes and a coat and trudged to the outbuilding and then the flyer. She tried to start it, but I had removed an essential part and kept it close. When she returned to the house, she had at least the presence of mind to close both doors before she tracked snow into the main room, where I sat on a bench holding Striegen's stringed instrument. She stared, unable to conceal her surprise, still shrugging slightly, uncomfortable in the heavy coat, itchy. "I want to leave," she said in a voice oddly half-cowed and half-arrogant, commanding Rodchai. "We'll leave when I'm ready," I said, and fingered a few notes on the instrument. Her feelings were too raw for her to be able to conceal them just now, and her anger and despair showed plainly on her face. "You are where you are," I said, in an even tone, "as a result of decisions you made yourself." Her spine straightened, her shoulders went back. "You don't know anything about me, or what decisions I have or haven't made." It was enough to make me angry again. I knew something about making decisions and not making them. "Ah, I forget. Everything happens as Amat wills. Nothing is your fault." Her eyes went wide. She opened her mouth to speak, drew breath, but then blew it out, sharp and shaky. She turned her back, ostensibly to remove her outer coat and drop it on a nearby bench. "You don't understand," she said, contemptuous, but her voice trembled with suppressed tears. "You're not Rodchai." "Not civilized." "Did you start taking Kef before or after you left the Roch?" It shouldn't have been available in Rodchai territory, but there was always some minor smuggling station authorities might turn a blind eye toward. She slumped down onto the bench beside where she'd sloppily left her coat. "I want tea." "There's no tea here." I set the instrument aside. "There's milk." More specifically, there was fermented bove milk, which the people here thinned with water and drank warm. The smell, and taste, was reminiscent of sweaty boots. And too much of it would likely make Savarden slightly sick. "What sort of place doesn't have tea?" she demanded, but leaned forward, elbows on her knees, and put her forehead on her wrists, her bare hands palm up, fingers outstretched. "This sort of place," I answered. "Why were you taking Kef?"
"You wouldn't understand."
Tears dropped into her lap. "Try me." I picked up the instrument again, picked out a tune. After 6 seconds of silent weeping, Savarden said,
"She said it would make everything clearer."
"The Kef would?" No answer. What would be clearer?
I know that song, she said, her face still resting on her wrists. I realized it was very likely the only way she would recognize me and change to a different tune. In one region of Valsky, singing was a refined pastime. Local choral associations, the center of social activity. That annexation had brought me a great deal of the sort of music I had liked best, when I had had more than one voice. I chose one of those. Savardin wouldn't know it. Valsky had been both before and after her time. She said, Savardin said finally, lifting her face from her hands, that emotions clouded perception, that the clearest sight was pure reason, undistorted by feeling. That's not true. I'd had a week with this instrument and very little else to do. I managed two lines at once. It seemed true at first. It was wonderful at first. It all went away. But then it would wear off, and things would be the same, only worse. And then after a while, it was like not feeling felt bad. I don't know. I can't describe it. But if I took more, that went away. And coming down got less and less endurable. I'd heard the story a few times in the past 20 years. Oh, Amat's grace, she moaned. I want to die. Why don't you? I changed to another song. My heart is a fish hiding in the water grass, in the green. She looked at me as though I were a rock that had just spoken. You lost your ship, I said. You were frozen for 1,000 years. You wake up to find that the Roch has changed. No more invasions. A humiliating treaty with a Presger. Your house has lost financial and social status. No one knows you or remembers you or cares whether you live or die. It's not what you were used to, not what you were expecting out of your life, is it? It took 3 puzzled seconds for the fact to dawn. You know who I am. Of course I know who you are. You told me, I lied. She blinked, tearily, trying, I supposed, to remember if she had or not. But her memories were, of course, incomplete. Go to sleep, I said, and laid my fingers across the strings, silencing them. I want to leave, she protested, not moving, still slumped on the bench, elbows on her knees. Why can't I leave? I have business here, I told her. She curled her lip and scoffed. She was right, of course. Waiting here was foolish. After so many years, so much planning and effort, I had failed. Still, go back to bed. Bed was the pallet of cushions and blankets beside the bench where she sat. She looked at me, half sneering still, and contemptuous, and slid down to the floor and lay, pulled a blanket over herself. She wouldn't sleep at first, I was sure. She would be trying to think of some way to leave, to overpower me, or convince me to do what she wanted. Any such planning would be useless, until she knew what she wanted, of course. But I didn't say that. Within the hour, her muscles slackened and her breathing slowed. Had she still been my lieutenant, I would have known for certain she slept, known what stage of sleep she was in, known whether or not she dreamed. Now I could only see externals. Still wary, I sat on the floor leaning against another bench and pulled a blanket up over my legs. As I had done every time I'd slept here, I opened my inner coat and put my hand on my gun, leaned back, and closed my eyes. 2 hours later, a faint sound woke me. I lay unmoving, my hand still on my gun. The faint sound repeated itself, slightly louder. The second door closing. I opened my eyes, just the slightest bit. Savardin lay too quiet on her pallet. Surely she had heard the sound as well. Through my eyelashes, I saw a person in outdoor clothes. Just under 2 meters tall, thin under the bulk of the double coat, skin iron gray. When she pushed back her hood, I saw her hair was the same. She was certainly not a Nilter. She stood watching me and Savardin for 7 seconds, and then quietly stepped to where I lay and bent to pull my pack toward her with one hand. In the other hand, she held a gun, pointed steadily at me, though she seemed not to know I was awake. The lock baffled her for a few moments, and then she pulled a tool out of her pocket, which she used to bypass the lock quite a bit more quickly than I had anticipated. Her gun still trained on me, and glancing occasionally at still motionless Savardin, she emptied the pack. Spare clothes, ammunition but no gun, so she would know or suspect that I was armed. 3 foil-wrapped packets of concentrated rations, eating utensils, and a bottle for water. A gold disc 5 centimeters in diameter, 1.5 centimeters thick, that she puzzled over, frowning, and then set aside. A box, which she opened to find money. She let out an astonished breath when she realized how much, and looked over at me. I didn't move. I don't know what she had thought she would find, but she seemed not to have found it, whatever it was. She picked up the disc that had puzzled her, and sat on a bench from which she had a clear view of both me and Savardin. Turning the disc over, she found the trigger. The sides fell away, opening like a flower, and the mechanism disgorged the icon. A person nearly naked, except for short trousers and tiny jewel and enamel flowers. The image smiled, serene. She had 4 arms. One hand held a ball, the other arm was encased in a cylindrical arm guard. Her other hands held a knife and a severed head, which dripped jeweled blood at her bare feet. The head smiled, the same smile of saintly, utter calm as she did. Striegen. It had to be Striegen. Frowned. The icon had been unexpected. It had piqued her curiosity yet further. I opened my eyes. She tightened her grip on her gun, the gun I was now looking at as closely as I could. Now my eyes were fully open, now I could turn my head toward it. Striegen held the icon out, raised a steel-gray eyebrow. Relative? She asked in Rodchai. I kept my face pleasantly neutral. Not exactly, I said in her own language. I thought I knew what you were when you came, she said after a long silence, thankfully following my language switch. I thought I knew what you were doing here. Now I'm not so sure. She glanced at Savardin, to all appearances completely undisturbed by our talking. I think I know who he is. But who are you? What are you? Don't tell me Breck from the Gerentate. You're as Rodchai as that one. She gestured slightly toward Savardin with her elbow. I came here to buy something, I said, determined to keep from staring at the gun she held. He's incidental. Since we weren't speaking Rodchai, I had to take gender into account. Striegen's language required it. The society she lived in professed at the same time to believe gender was insignificant. Males and females dressed, spoke, acted indistinguishably. And yet no one I'd met had ever hesitated or guessed wrong. And they had invariably been offended when I did hesitate or guess wrong. I hadn't learned the trick of it. I'd been in Striegen's own apartment, seen her belongings, and still wasn't sure what forms to use with her now. Incidental? Asked Striegen, disbelieving. I couldn't blame her.
I wouldn't have believed it myself except I knew it to be true. Striegan said nothing else, likely realizing that to say much more would be extremely foolish, if I was what she feared I was. Coincidence, I said. Glad on at least one count that we weren't speaking Rodchai, where the word implied significance. I found him unconscious. If I'd left him where he was, he'd have died. Striegan didn't believe that either, from the look she gave me. Why are you here? She laughed, short and bitter, whether because I'd chosen the wrong gender for the pronoun or something else, I wasn't certain. I think that's my question to ask. She hadn't corrected my grammar, at least. I came to talk to you, to buy something. Savardin was ill. You weren't here. I'll pay you for what we've eaten, of course. She seemed to find that amusing for some reason. Why are you here? She asked. I'm alone, I said, answering her unspoken question. Except for him. I nodded at Savardin. My hand was still on my gun, and Striegan likely knew why I kept that hand so still under my coat. Savardin still feigned sleep. Striegan shook her head slightly, disbelieving. I'd have sworn you were a corpse soldier. An ancillary, she meant. When you arrived, I was certain of it. She'd been hiding nearby then, waiting for us to leave, and the entire place had been under her surveillance. She must have trusted her hiding place quite extravagantly. If I had been what she feared, staying anywhere near would have been extremely foolish. I would certainly have found her. But when you saw there was no one here, you wept. And him. She shrugged toward Savardin, slack and motionless on the pallet. Sit up, citizen, I said to Savardin in Rodchai. You're not fooling anyone. Fuck off, she answered, and pulled a blanket over her head, then shoved it off again and rose, slightly shaky, and went into the sanitary facility and closed the door. I turned back to Striegan. That business with the flyer rental, was that you? She shrugged ruefully. He told me a couple of Rodchai were coming out this way. Either he badly underestimated you, or you're even more dangerous than I thought. Which would be considerably dangerous. I'm used to being underestimated, and you didn't tell her, him, why you thought I was coming. Her gun hadn't wavered. Why are you here? You know why I'm here. A quick change in her expression instantly suppressed. I continued. Not to kill you. Killing you would defeat the purpose. She raised an eyebrow, tilted her head slightly. Would it? The fencing, the fainting frustrated me. I want the gun. What gun? Striegan would never be so foolish as to admit the thing existed, that she knew what gun I was talking about. But her pretended ignorance didn't convince. She knew. If she had what I thought she had, what I had gambled my life she had, further specificity would be unnecessary. She knew. Whether she would give it to me was another question. I'll pay you for it.
I don't know what you're talking about.
The Garcetta, I did everything in fives. Five right actions, five principal sins, five zones times five regions. 25 representatives to surrender to the Lord of the Roch. For 3 seconds, Striegan was utterly still. Even her breathing seemed to have stopped. Then she spoke.
Gar said, is it? What does that have to do with me?
I'd never have guessed if you'd stayed where you were.
Gar said was 1,000 years ago, and very, very far away from here.
25 representatives to surrender to the Lord of the Roch, I repeated. And 24 guns recovered or otherwise accounted for.
She blinked, drew in a breath.
Who are you?
Someone ran. Someone fled the system before the Rajshahi arrived. Maybe she was afraid the guns wouldn't work as advertised. Maybe she knew that even if they did, it wouldn't help.
On the contrary, no. Wasn't that the point? No one defies Anander Mianai.
She spoke bitterly.
Not if they want to live.
I said nothing. Striegan's hold on the gun didn't waver. Even so, she was in danger from me if I decided to harm her, and I thought she suspected that.
I don't know why you think I have this gun you're talking about. Why would I have it?
You collected antiques, curiosities. You already had a small collection of Gar Sedai artifacts. They'd made their way to Dras Anya station somehow. Others might do so as well. And then one day you disappeared. You took care you wouldn't be followed.
That's a very slight basis for such a large assumption.
So why this? I gestured carefully with my free hand, the other still under my coat holding my gun. You had a comfortable post on Dras Anya. Patience, plenty of money, associations and reputation. Now you're in the icy middle of nowhere giving first aid to bove herders.
Personal crisis,
she said, the words carefully, deliberately pronounced. Certainly, I agreed. You couldn't bring yourself to destroy it, or pass it on to someone who might not be wise enough to realize what a danger it presented. You knew, as soon as you realized what you had, that if Rotch authorities ever even dreamed of half imagining it existed, they would track you down and kill you and anyone else who might have seen it. While the Rotch wanted everyone to remember what had happened to the Gar Sedai, they wanted no one to know just how the Gar Sedai had managed to do what they'd done. What no one had managed to do for 1,000 years before or another 1,000 years after. Destroy a Rajshahi ship. Almost no one alive remembered. I knew, and any still extant ships that had been there. Anander Mianai certainly did. And Saevardin, who had seen for herself what the Lord of the Rotch wanted no one to think was possible. That invisible armor and gun. Those bullets that defeated Rajshahi armor. And her ship's heat shield, so effortlessly. I want it, I told Striegan. I'll pay you for it. If I had such a thing, if... It's entirely possible no amount of money in the world would be sufficient. Anything is possible, I agreed. You're Rajshahi and you're military. Was, I corrected. And when she scoffed, I added, if I still were, I wouldn't be here. Or if I were, you would already have given me whatever information I wanted, and you'd be dead.
Get out of here.
Striegan's voice was quiet but vehement.
Take your stray with you.
I'm not leaving until I have what I came for. There would be little point in doing so. You'll have to give it to me or shoot me with it. As much as admitting I still had armor, implying I was precisely what she feared, a Rajshahi agent come to kill her and take the gun. Frightened of me as she must be, she couldn't avoid her own curiosity.
Why do you want it so badly?
I want, I told her, to kill Anander Mianai.
What?
The gun in her hand trembled, moved slightly aside, then steadied again. She leaned forward 3 millimeters and cocked her head as though she was certain she hadn't heard me correctly. I want to kill Anander Mianai, I repeated.
Anander Mianai, she said bitterly, has thousands of bodies in hundreds of locations. You can't possibly kill him.
Certainly not with one gun. I still want to try.
You're insane. Or is that even possible? Aren't all